Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today, Speaking in Maine takes us to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations at Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. Jessica Matthews is a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She served as the Carnegie's president for 18 years. She was director on the Council on Foreign Relations from 1994 to 97, served on the editorial board of the Washington Post from 1980 to 82, and later wrote a popular weekly column for the Washington Post that appeared nationwide and in the former International Herald Tribune. From 1977 to 79, she was director of the Office of Global Issues at the National Security Council, covering nuclear proliferation, conventional arms sales, and human rights. She served on the staff of the Committee on Energy and the Environment of the Interior Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast on our website, mpbn.net. Introducing Ms. Matthews is Mac DeFord of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the July meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout, the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum, which was founded in 1983. For over 31 years, that's over 350 meetings, the forum has been gathering on a monthly basis to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen, journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, some of whom are experts in their own right. Details about our past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're really delighted and honored to have as our speaker Jessica Matthews. Since February, she's been a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, having served before that for 18 years as Carnegie's president. From 1994 to 1997, she was director of the Council on Foreign Relations Washington program. She's currently a member of the Harvard Corporation, which is Harvard's senior governing board. She's also a trustee of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. She's previously served on the board of Radcliffe College, the Inter-American Dialogue, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Century Foundation, and the Brookings Institution. She co-founded the Surface Transportation Policy Project, and since 2001 has served as director of SomaLogic, a leading biotech firm in the breakthrough field of proteomics. She holds a PhD in molecular biology from the California Institute of Technology and graduated magna cum laude from Radcliffe. So please, a really warm welcome for Jessica Matthews. That warm welcome was too early. Her topic, A World of Challenge, Can the United States Still Lead? Thanks.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, to envy all you lucky people who will stay here after we leave, and have a chance to have a discussion with you about where U.S. foreign policy is today in broad terms and where we're headed. There's a new book out called Superpower, not a very good title, but by a well-known expert in this field, Ian Bremmer, and he begins by saying flatly, the incoherence in American foreign policy has been growing for 25 years. And that's his thesis as he launches into this book. I think it's wrong, at the very least a considerable overstatement, and a surprising one from somebody who is so knowledgeable. But it's an indicator of the degree of kind of angst and uncertainty and criticism that is coming at U.S. foreign policy, both from the scholarly and analyst community and from foreign governments and leaders in the private sector as well abroad. It's more than the debate we endlessly have among different schools of thought on U.S. foreign policy, among neocons, realists, and internationalists. This is something that goes more to the basic questions of what we should try to do in very rapidly changing circumstances at home and abroad, what we actually can do, And whether there isn't some kind of unifying principle that would impose a greater sense of consistency on what we're doing around the world. Just to give you a sense of how many manifestations this feeling has, I was in a room about the size of European leaders a few weeks ago, government officials and private sector leaders, listening to them bemoan the lack of U.S. commitment to NATO. And considering that the U.S. contributes more than twice as much to the NATO budget as all the European countries combined, this was a little hard to understand. It's also the case that there was a recent poll by the Pew Research Center, very large poll, of citizens in 8 NATO countries, and only in the United States and Canada did a majority of people, and it wasn't a very big majority, but at least it was a majority, agree that the country should go to the help of a NATO ally if they were attacked. And of course, that's the core of the NATO treaty, Article 5, that requires every NATO country to go to, that's what collective defense means. So only in the US today and Canada does that command a majority of public opinion. If you go, and I'm sure there are people in this room who've been there recently, but if you go throughout the Sunni Middle East, the fear of a U.S. withdrawal is pervasive. And yet the United States maintains dozens of bases and a large naval fleet in and around the Persian Gulf. It has major facilities and a significant number of troops in Qatar, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, has been for many years our largest geographic unified command. We have operations out of Jordan, out of Turkey. Yet, if you go have a conversation in any of these countries in the region today, and immediately you will hear this fear that the United States is going to lose interest tomorrow and go home. In East Asia, governments from Beijing to U.S. allies are wondering whether America intends to remain indefinitely the predominant power in the Pacific, and whether the famous or infamous pivot, still largely invisible in practice, is actually about containing China, which, by the way, is what China thinks. And what it might eventually mean in practice if we ever get around to actually changing something because of this new policy. Criticism of the United States by friends and allies is absolutely nothing new. It goes with the territory of being the dominant power, and the sense of there having been a golden age of coherence in foreign policy and of domestic consensus is unreal. That age never existed. Even when we did have a single guiding principle, containment of the Soviet Union, which could guide everything from going to the moon to going to Vietnam to building an interstate highway system, which was originally justified as a way to move missiles around the country. So we shouldn't think somehow once upon a time we did all agree on what the U.S. should do, but I do think, I do go this far with Bremer and many others who are writing now, that something different is going on now, with more fundamental questions being asked, and that's what I wanted to try to explore with you today. Is it really as bad as some people think? And in particular, where are we headed? And is there any sense of a direction that would get a greater sense of widespread support? If I could, I want to start by giving you a very quick gallop through where we've come since the end of the Cold War, so last 25 years. The first reaction was a very brief moment of celebration. After 50 years of struggle, we won. And for a little while, it seemed like this was the permanent triumph of democracy and market capitalism, and all the problems were over, and Frank Fukuyama wrote that silly piece called The End of History. And but that didn't last too long. There was then a sense that this was at last, after all this spending, all this effort, a time to turn inward and to reap the peace dividend, the so-called peace dividend. And that led almost immediately to a sense of fears about a renewal of American isolationism. But history didn't leave us alone, and it was clear that we could no longer be an isolationist country. And it morphed into this era of unilateralism. And if you think about it, isolationism, unilateralism are actually close cousins. It's just a different way of ignoring the rest of the world. Just to give you a sense of what it meant in practice, because we have come pretty long distance. In this period, in the 1990s, the U.S. stood apart from the rest of the world, and in particular from our allies in Europe, with respect to all of the major international initiatives of the period, to the creation of an international criminal court, to the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, to a ban on anti-personnel landmines, to a new treaty to preserve biodiversity, to a verification mechanism to make the Biological Weapons Control Treaty tough. We unilaterally abrogated the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the ABM treaty, so that we could begin to build a national missile defense. And shockingly, the Senate rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was an American initiative and for which we had been the major proponent for decades. Almost all of these occurred during the Clinton administration, so this was not a Republican-Democratic thing. And these were not close calls. The votes in the UN, just to give you some idea, the landmine ban, the vote was 142-0 with 18 abstentions. The criminal court, the vote was 120-7 with 21 abstentions. At Kyoto, it was 178-1. With the exception of India and Israel in a few cases, not a single democracy voted the way we did on any of these. And the countries which did were China, Iran, Iraq, Libya, and Cuba. Internally, internationally, excuse me, in this period, in the 1990s, we had, while the U.S. was turning away from the world, two things going on, two general trends. On the one hand, a burst of international activity in the U.N. and through other international institutions. In the years immediately after the end of the Cold War, the U.N. began undertaking peacekeeping missions all over the world. By 1994, there were 13 of them underway, 17 of them underway, and more money was spent in that 1 year on peacekeeping than it had been spent in the previous 48 years. So 13 peacekeeping missions over half a century, and 17 by 1994 in 1 year at one time. Very few of these were actually the kind of straightforward peacekeeping mission between two states that had fought themselves to a place where they wanted to make peace. Instead, they were much messier, generally from factions within a state, very often where there wasn't really a peace to keep, and in which huge humanitarian crises were mixed up with a political and military one. So they became, although there was an enormous effort to do them, it became kind of a mess. And as the decade progressed, the U.S. got more and more worried about the U.N., its efficiency, its effectiveness. There was a growing sense of disenchantment, a desire for greater performance. And that morphed into, or was taken advantage of by those who wanted to see the UN much weaker. And by the middle of the decade, starting 95, 96, 97, the US had become the greatest fiscal delinquent in the world. At that time, we owed the UN $1.2 billion. This is 1 year. $40 million to the World Health Organization, $95 million to the Food and Agriculture Organization, $200 million to the World Bank's development arm, the International Development Association. And all of these numbers were assessed legal obligations. They were not voluntary pledges. They were dues. And so the message we sent, which was quickly picked up by others, was international law doesn't mean much. Sort of voluntary, what had always been seen as hard obligations. We also stepped away from all kinds of commitments we had made voluntarily, pledges to the development banks, the regional development banks, totaling almost $500 million, to the Global Environmental Facility, which was only a couple of years old. We were in arrears to the OECD. We were in arrears to the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And the result was that this encouraged others not to pay or to wait till the end of the year, and the UN was very quickly teetering on the brink of bankruptcy because they could neither print money nor did they have financial reserves. And so they responded by not paying the peacekeepers, and so the likes of Bangladesh and Pakistan were covering our bad check. So the other important trend of the 90s and of the years that followed after was a growing turn in the United States away from diplomacy and towards military solutions. We've gone to war or undertaken significant military operations 9 times in 25 years. Three major wars, the Gulf War in 91, the Afghanistan War, the Iraq War. Also Serbia over Kosovo, Bosnia, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and now the drone war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Two of those wars are the longest in our history, and only one of them was a clear-cut victory, the Gulf War in 91. But the clear trend has been more and more of a turn to using our military arm as a solution to all kinds of problems. To give you another example of how acute this became, in 96, Congress not only funded all of the administration's request for the Pentagon budget, but added $7 billion to that budget. That $7 billion would have covered all of U.S. diplomacy and operations abroad, all of its development aid to poor countries, all of its UN dues, all of its voluntary pledges, and its share of the World Bank cost combined. But as I told you, we were in deep, deep delinquency. So we had become with a very asymmetric sense of where we wanted to put our resources and our efforts. So we had a period of extreme unilateralism, the unipolar moment. The Bush administration, with the Iraq War, making really pushing aside international law in several places. And from that unilateralist soil came the 9/11 attacks and a flowering of even stronger sentiment that of American exceptionalism, that our role is so special and so important and so unique that we are entitled not only to make the rules internationally, but to ignore them when we choose. And that had to, I gave you the example of our international, our fiscal dues, the undertaking of preventive war in Iraq, which is entirely illegitimate under international law, and tendency towards regime change at will, imposing secondary boycotts. It's a very long list where we violate the rules that we have largely set. And so the feeling of the work of creating international institutions, the frustrating, slow work of nurturing them, of building norms, of making international law, was not only seen in this period as slow and maybe not worth the effort, but actively harmful to U.S. interests. And more diplomacy was seen as not a serious tool for solving security issues. And one of the reasons that I think that the Iran deal, if it is completed and implemented, will be so important is that it will be the first time that we have used diplomacy to address a hard security issue in decades, a major hard security issue. So I haven't yet mentioned the most important trend of these years, of course, which is globalization, driven, you know, primarily by the information revolution, but not entirely so. It makes it a nice way to kind of look at this period because 1990 was really the year that the information revolution took off. Everybody is familiar with Moore's Law, but it's become so familiar to us, it's hard to kind of put it into practice, but I mean into practical terms. One way which I think really captures it, which is that if the cost of automotive technology had gone down between 1970 and the year 2000, at the same rate that the cost of computing power went down, then a new car in the year 2000 would have cost somewhere between $15 and $20. And that's what it means. And Moore's Law continues to hold and may, in fact, accelerate going forward. So we have come through a period of globalization where borders are not what they once were. They are now really porous. We've got trillions of dollars sloshing around in cyberspace. We've got environmental change, particularly climate, but others as well that ignore borders. We've got the rise of transnational criminal networks. We've got cybersecurity problems that are immense. It has meant also the development of geographically dispersed but tightly knit national diasporas, which have become very important drivers of policy. And altogether, what it means is that it's making it harder and harder for nation states to satisfy their citizens' needs and demands. It has also meant rapidly growing international trade and even more rapidly growing foreign direct investment. Altogether, a demand for transnational governance and cooperation to address all those issues that way outstrips the supply of international governance. And to a degree that I think would surprise all of us, which where we rightly think of ourselves as a leader, one of the big reasons for that lack of supply of international governance right now is that the United States can no longer ratify a treaty. It's been 15 years since we, except for the New START Treaty, which was a very modest but important arms control treaty and which took the administration going absolutely to the mat and promising to spend a lot of money that shouldn't be spent on nuclear weapons. We have not been able to ratify a treaty in the Senate, and nobody believes that we can. So going into the climate summit the end of this year, countries are searching for some way to make binding obligations on climate and know that the thing that's normally you would turn to, which is a treaty, is off the table because the United States couldn't ratify it. This is a really, and so people are trying to turn them, you know, tie themselves in knots to think about what can we do instead. So I want to just spend a minute talking about what has happened at home in this period, because I think it's, as this example makes clear, it's really related. Two trends that to me seem the defining ones. And one is a deepening polarization across the country, and the other is growing dysfunction in Washington. Again, related. We've had, you know, periodic collisions with the debt ceiling, and we're about to have another, which have produced government shutdowns instead of a routine adjustment of the debt ceiling. fights over deficits that produced a measure that was designed to be so dumb and so crude and so obviously a bad idea that it would never be implemented, was implemented. And we have the sequester, and now the big question is, can we get rid of it? And it's not so clear that we can. Major laws, federal transportation law, which is supposed to be debated and in policy context and reset every 6 years. It's been 7 years since it was last renewed, and Congress is reduced to funding automatic extensions of the funding every 90 days instead of every 6 years, but with no policy discussion. It's been 22 years since we last raised the federal gasoline tax. The education bill that's being debated in Congress as we, not exactly as we speak, but last week, and is 8 years overdue. We have a non-functional national legislature. It took 45 years, as you all know, to take the first step on health care after Medicare and Medicaid. And it is not, of course, universal health insurance. It isn't even health care reform. It is health insurance reform. And we are now spending per capita 2.5 times the OECD average, the average of advanced countries, and score on public health issues way down the list on infant mortality, life expectancy, and the like. The growth of spending is entirely unsustainable in healthcare. And although the new advances that are coming out of genomics and proteomics, enormously important, enormously exciting, I think in 5 years we will look back at the way we currently practice medicine today and it will feel like the Middle Ages. But at least in the near term, it will add cost. I think long term it will cut costs, but it will add in the near term. The other major trend that we have not yet begun to grapple with, which is the rise of inequality. Since 1980, 80% of American households have lost ground economically. Even though in this period, a huge proportion of them went from one earner to two earner households as women entered the workforce en masse. The bottom 80% that has not gained in that period currently accounts for 7% of all our financial assets. The 20%, the lucky 20%, most of the gains went to the top 1%, and of the top 1%, believe it or not, most of the gains went to the top 0.1%. And the same is true of after-tax income. Not quite so acutely, but basically the same picture. The ratio of CEO pay to average workers' pay went from 40 to 1 in the 60s to over 400 to 1 today. So there are all kinds of reasons for this dysfunction. And some of them, you know, that certainly the sense of anger and fear of alienation from the federal government is certainly related to economic stagnation. When people are doing well, change is a much easier thing to cope with. Changes in our media, which now provides ammunition for positions rather than information, all those are important. But I think from my belief is that the biggest reason is money in politics. We've gone in this period through a 50-fold increase in the cost of an average seat in the House of Representatives, from $56,000 to just about $3 million for an average seat. The last presidential cycle came in at about $1 billion on each side, and it's predicted that the current one, 2016, will be between $2 and $3 billion on each side. They've been more than doubling each time. We've had drastic changes in lifestyle in Congress so that because of this, members have to go home to fundraise every weekend. They don't bring their families to Washington anymore. They live in sort of college dormitories practically, some of them, mostly. But what it means is they barely get to know their colleagues, much less those across the aisle. And that makes the kind of negotiation that you need to have to do difficult legislation vastly harder. But the most important thing is that the money chase drives policy to the ideological extremes. The most committed givers are the ones on the edges. Candidates then make promises that they have to try to keep, even if there's no chance of success. So you have the spectacle of the House of Representatives voting 53 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And it's not just campaigns, it's the actual act of governing, because that same money feeds the lobbying industry, which also was born in the 1970s. At that time, there were 150 businesses that were registered, that were represented by registered lobbyists in Washington. And today, there are basically none that are not. So we now have a system, political system, that is dominated and driven and defined by money. And if you put that together with the trends in inequality, you have a story of wealth that is concentrated at the top. The more the interests that have it can spend on the giving and the lobbying that in turn further widens their own advantage, the more the system feeds on itself. Both political parties are equally beholden to this system. And while it's neither illegal nor corrupt, it massively distorts representatives' attention and their priorities and legislative outcomes. And every attempt that we have made to fix the campaign finance problem through changes in the rules has either opened new loopholes or made this problem worse or been declared unconstitutional. We have seen the merging of political and economic power in Russia. And we talk about the dead end of state capitalism, look down our noses at it. We see a version of it in China. But the truth is that we have arrived, I think, by a very different route at something of the same point, at least at the federal level. We've walked into a cul-de-sac from which I don't see any obvious means of escape short of some terrible economic crisis. So to return to where I began, what can we think of foreign policy looking ahead and in the face of all the criticism of it at home and abroad today? My sense is that we face challenges now on three very different planes, where it used to be basically one plane, and that was the geopolitical state-to-state relationships, largely military and security-driven. We now have a set of those problems. We have a set of post-Westphalian problems that are not defined principally by state-to-state relationships, and that are not defined principally by conflict, but by the need for cooperation. And we have this gridlock, this very tightly connected gridlock and dysfunction at home, which is intimately connected not just to the appearance that we send abroad and what others think of it, but what we can do abroad and what Americans are willing to try. And any strategy that I think addresses only one of these is going to fail. It's not, I think, an unbearably or unmanageably broad agenda. For me, there are, on the first plane, three issues. They're big, but it's a manageable number. There's Russia. How do you deal with an angry country that is hurting, that has lost its sense of self-regard, that is really good at playing the role of spoiler? How do you deal with China, a rising power, which in history very seldom have you been able to incorporate a rising power into an established world order without conflict? How could we do that now? And as China changes from being a rule taker that simply adopts a system that was created by the West for the benefit of the West to being a rule maker. How do we manage China? And how do we manage a Middle East that's in chaos, where the state system is in shreds in so many of the countries, where we may in fact be on, you know, seeing the early stages of a 30-year religious war, 30 years war. Those are our three challenges abroad, in my eyes. On the second plane, there are a dozen issues, but the two that stand out to me are climate, which is an existential threat, and cybersecurity. Listen to the CEO of one of the leading cyber firms that manages security, who described the current situation as bank robbery without cops. It's, you know, the countries and forces that are doing this hacking, you know, have opened an artery, and it's just freely bleeding intellectual property. We're spending a lot of time agonizing over hacking of government secrets, and those are serious, very serious. But the loss of commercial value in intellectual property that's going on, the average time it takes for most companies to detect a hack is over 200 days. You can lose an awful lot of intellectual property in 200 days. And finally, on the third plane, the two things that I think we have to address, I wish I had more answers to how, political polarization and growing economic inequality, which together I think have made it extremely difficult for us to be able to speak with a single voice abroad. We see the politicization of foreign policy in the Iran deal, in international economics. Larry Summers, the former Secretary of the Treasury, said the other day, when you have one party that doesn't like international trade and one party that doesn't like international organizations, it's very difficult to exercise economic leadership. And he's, of course, quite right. If you cannot ratify treaties in the Senate, if you cannot really address major agreements like the Iran deal on their merits, you have a problem in exercising leadership. So to return to where I began, the world still needs U.S. leadership, because if not us, who? But things really have profoundly changed from the leadership era that we remember from the Cold War. One superpower is a lot harder to deal with than two. We do not automatically command followership as we did when the Soviet threat was there. We have to deserve it. Countries don't need to follow us out of fear of the Soviet Union. They do it out of positive choice because they agree with us on the definition of issues. We have a world that's in transition from a Westphalian era where everything was neatly within national borders, everything of value, to a world, a post-Westphalian world, where lots of things are outside state borders. We have globalization weakening the power of all states to meet their citizens' demands and needs. And we are in a uniquely bad situation domestically, at least uniquely in a very long period. What this doesn't mean, though, I think, is that U.S. policy is incoherent. I think that what we're facing is a world that expects an awful lot more of us than we can deliver, and in fact expects a lot more of us than they want us to deliver. Because in the you remember during the unipolar moment, we were not popular. It is not a time when a single strategy is going to emerge. I doubt very much that we will come back to the sort of nice, neat period of containment. And it was not as neat, as I pointed out, as it seems in hindsight. But we are going to have to deliver strategies that make sense for Russia, that make sense with dealing with a rising China, that make sense with dealing with a crumbling Middle East. These are totally different problems, and really only very little ties them together. So the good news is, like Wagner's music, our foreign policy is better than it sounds. That, by the way, was not me. It was Mark Twain. But we do have, we are facing a period where we're going to have to do some really serious rethinking of our posture abroad and what we can deliver, as well as what we feel we want to deliver, and where we are going to have to solve some big challenges at home in order to deliver it. So I know, I realize I've raised perhaps more questions than I've provided answers. But I do think that's where we are, and I hope it has maybe shed a little light on an interesting time and an interesting period ahead. So thank you so much.
That was really, it was terrific. I won't say it was uplifting, but it was certainly... certainly terrific. All right, so we have a number of questions. First one goes to Iran. Will the likely deal with Iran, do you think that's going to lead to greater stability in the Middle East? Will it benefit or undermine United States, our national security?
I think if this deal happens, it will be a huge positive step. It will... If it did not happen, if Iran became a nuclear power, I think we would see three or four other nuclear powers in the Middle East in short order: Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. I hardly need to say that that's not something we would like to see. It will be, as I said, you know, the use of diplomacy to solve a problem. It will be an enormous strengthening of the non-proliferation system, which is greatly important in and of itself. But it will also, as we know, it drastically unsettles the Sunni Gulf states, and we will have to develop policies to wrap our arms around Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, and deal with that nervousness. And that's not that difficult to do, but we have to do it. And we also will have to try to, if we can, to mediate in some way between the two now contending Middle East powers, Sunni, Saudi Arabia, Shia, Iran, who are in direct conflict now in Yemen, and indirect conflict all over. So it won't change Iran in lots of the other policies that we would like to see changed. But it opens the way, and so I do not think that the deal ought to be accepted on its own merits as an arms control agreement. And that's big enough. But we shouldn't expect to see it change Iran's attitude towards Israel, towards the Palestinian problem, towards Sunni states, towards its human rights problems, its the policies that we don't like at home. None of those things will change as a result of the deal. And in the short term, some of them make it worse, both because Iran will have more money to spend on some of those things when the sanctions are lifted, and because I think the Supreme Leader will need to take a tilt to the right to satisfy the right wing, which will be deeply angered by the deal. So it will create some challenges, but, you know, overall, if it were not for Bibi Netanyahu, and if it were not for Republican politics now, and this deal is going to get caught up in primary battles over the summer, This deal, in my view, is a complete no-brainer. And just one final other word. The other thing that's really important to remember about it is that it is not a bilateral deal. We can't walk away from it as though, if we chose to, as though it were a U.S.-Iranian deal. What is one of the things that is most important about what happened and most impressive is that all the great powers, except Japan, the U.S., the U.K., France, Germany, Russia, with whom we have agreed on nothing for a long time, and China, have worked in lockstep to make this thing happen. And so it's a major contribution in the development of world order as well.
Okay, before we get into some more general questions, here's a specific one about Russia. Did the United States overplay its hand vis-a-vis Russia in the immediate post-Cold War period, or would Putin have acted the way he has regardless?
We did in one important respect, and that was in the expansion of NATO eastward, and in particular raising, as George Bush did, the membership of Ukraine in NATO. In all other respects, I think we had a very positive set of policies towards Russia. It's just really hard to lose an empire. And people hurt. And they think of Russia as having been rich and strong at the end of the Cold War, and now weak and getting poorer as a nation, not individually. And there is an enormous feeling of anger, bitterness, that Putin has been able to latch onto and grow. But the thing we have to remember is what fertile soil he found for his propaganda. I mean, you can't sell anything. You have to sell something that people respond to, and boy, people have really responded. The polling numbers in Russia about how they feel towards the United States are astounding, how anti-American feeling has grown. But the only mistake I would score that's important in the post-Cold War era was not thinking through NATO expansion. And in the last 5 years, 5 years before 2014, really paying no attention to what was happening in Ukraine. It just was off our mental maps.
Okay, here's a sort of broader question. What do you think U.S. diplomacy would look like under a Hillary Clinton or a Jeb Bush?
I think that most of the political problems that I described, the problems at home, they attach to both parties. The politicization, the polarization, the dependence on money. It's we shouldn't define that as a partisan issue. There would be important differences. I think in foreign policy, Clinton-Bush redux, that's not where you'd see the big differences. You'd see the big differences in Supreme Court nominations and a whole range of other domestic policies. But I don't think those would be defining issues. Except that, I'll just say this, make this one caveat. I was troubled by Jeb Bush's bumbling of handling of the Iraq War, because I believe it is clearly the worst foreign policy decision of the last 50 years, at a minimum. It cost us Iraq and Afghanistan. You can't really separate them because so many people served in both. It's going to cost us long-term with healthcare costs somewhere between $5 and $6 trillion. It lost us support all over the world. It raised profound questions about what were U.S. goals, what were U.S. Intentions. It overshadowed all kinds of policies as being regime change, intended for regime. It was a terrible and an entirely unnecessary decision. And so the fact that, you know, I understand that he has to handle this carefully vis-a-vis his brother, but I don't get any sense that he thinks that. And my guess is Hillary probably thinks that.
You mentioned the Supreme Court at the beginning of your answer on this one, so here's a question. To what extent is the Supreme Court, to what extent has it been a contributing factor on sort of the downward path you described in the United States, especially the money in politics, et cetera, and what can be done about it, other than not letting Jeb Bush come in as president, as you mentioned?
Well, I am not a lawyer, and I am not I'm not qualified to answer that question, except to say that the Citizens United decision was terrible. And it directed money to the least accountable part of our system and the least transparent part. And I can't answer the part about how we get out of it, except that they will rethink. But it's not just this court, and it's not just Citizens United. Everything we've tried to do since the 1970s on campaign finance has been declared unconstitutional. And the problem just keeps getting worse.
Okay, here's a good question as a follow-up to that. Do you think the frustration of voters in the United States will someday boil over into some kind of civil resistance?
Well, I'm enough of an optimist to think not. I think our system is still healthy enough to produce change through our political system. But I do think that we are in something of a cul-de-sac on this money power problem, and I don't see a way out now. My only other thought on this is that if you look back over the last 50 years at the big transformative changes that we've gone through, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, all of those came from outside government. And then you need government to institutionalize them. But the engine of change came from outside. And my guess is that that's where it will come again, institutions like this one.
All right, how about the State Department? You know, all the diplomatic problems we face. Is the State Department in eclipse? Foreign policy seems to be made when it's made at all in the White House or Congress.
It certainly has been, but it certainly, it has been under President Obama. But it's also quite clear, I mean, Secretary Kerry has spent, I think, 18 days or 16 days, basically 20 hours a day in these negotiations. This is as hands-on policymaking as you can possibly get. And it's easy for it to change. A president who appoints a really strong Secretary of State and empowers that person to be a really strong Secretary of State, it can change overnight. There's nothing built into the system that makes this happen this way, except the growth of the National Security Council to become a mini State Department in the White House, which is a terrible mistake. It was never intended to be that, and it's not what it's for. It's to think about strategy, not to execute policy. And so I don't see this as, I mean, it has been a problem, but I don't see this as one going forward necessarily.
Okay, how about this? What are the chances we can move from a model of international leadership by a single nation to a more collaborative effort?
Well, this is what the views are of the people who are called liberal internationalists, that legitimacy matters. that collective action matters, that the U.S. should not act outside rule of international law. The problem is that international agreements really do need leadership, that you seldom get in the past. We've had actually in the recent past a couple of examples where the U.S. was actually in opposition. Several of the examples I gave you where the U.S. voted no, the International Anti-Personnel Landmine Treaty, which is a huge humanitarian achievement, happened totally without the United States. It happened because Canada and Australia and Austria, three middle-sized powers, worked with a very broad-based NGO coalition, international, but broad-based across a whole lot of issues, and made this thing happen in warp speed of this treaty almost overnight. The U.S. still has not signed it. The administration, the Obama administration, has been thinking about it for 6 years. But we have this problem in Korea. We've been abiding by it, but we haven't been, at least we haven't been destroying our minds in Korea, but we haven't been putting new ones down. So I think we're a long way, you know, from seeing major international achievements, big ones on the level that I described as what I think of our major challenges, without the U.S. in the lead, because I don't see where the energy, the drive, the direction comes from without us. But it has to be, I think, over time, if that's the direction we will have to move, because legitimacy matters more and more. And sets of expectation about how international agreement ought to work are moving in this direction.
So here's the final question. When you advise young people on their career objectives, considering the world that we live in today, where would you steer them? Business, law, the UN, NGOs, Congress, politics, the military?
All of the above. What I tell people, and I get asked it all the time, is try to find out what you love because you will do it best. And all of those, all that whole list, are all involved and all critical to the success of a set of international relations, international policies. So the choice is, do you care about the welfare of the country? And if you do, this is as an exciting and challenging a career as you could find anywhere in any of those sectors.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today, our speaker was Jessica Matthews, Distinguished Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former Director on the Council of Foreign Relations and respected author. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast on our website, mpbn.net. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.